As I said, last Sunday morning we started this new series all about relationships. And we said last Sunday morning that I gave you three pillars that will help you understand every type of relationship you have. The first one was, we are relational because God is relational. The second one was that our relationships are all damaged. And they're damaged because of the fall, because we're sinners, and that affects every relationship. And then the third one was that in our relationships, our aim is to restore the image of God in us. And one of the main ways we do that is by obeying his commands for relationships. That's part of the process of restoring God's image in us. Those three pillars will apply to every relationship we have. And before we get stuck into today's topic about marriage, let me just make, I've got three brief comments to make just about how this series will work. Again, these comments will apply to every session we do on this, I expect. Here's the first one. In the Bible, God doesn't give us an exhaustive manual that tells you what to do in every single circumstance. I know you probably know that already, but I think that's worth spelling out on a series like this. God gives us principles, but there will be so many circumstances where we won't be able to touch on them in this series. You may well find there's times when you think, but what about my particular situation? Or what about that one? What would you do if such and such happened? All these sorts of questions. I don't have a cookie-cutter mould relationship, so what do we do there? And we can lay out the principles in this series, but we won't be able to go into every different situation. Second comment to make, and again, this is obvious, I know, but it needs to be said. There are some relationships in this series that may well not apply directly to you. You may be here and you're not married this morning. Not everyone in this room is, but please don't zone out if the relationship we're studying doesn't apply directly to you today. Because we need to learn about all sorts of subjects that don't apply to us. Think about the Apostle Paul. When he writes in his letters, he writes specific commands in those letters to slaves, specific commands to children or fathers, and he does that even though everyone else would have been listening to those letters as they're being read out. So that's why in church life we still talk about depression or unemployment or illness, even though it doesn't necessarily affect every person in the room. I suppose part of it is we don't know what lies ahead for us in our lives, but also as a church, one of the things we're aiming to do is to help and support each other, be able to give wise counsel and advice. So all of God's word is still for all of us. Third comment before we get started is this. There will inevitably, I expect over the course of this series, be some topics that will be sensitive for you, that either bring back painful memories for you, or whether it's we think about friendship and it just reminds you of a friend that betrayed you. We'll think about the parent-child relationship, and it might make you think about parents who just they just weren't what you wanted them to be. Or in all our relationships, a series like this, I am aware that it may well touch on sensitive areas. And the intention isn't just to do that for the sake of it. It's not just to reopen old wounds or anything like that, but for us to learn. Because I said last week, relationships are so important. They play such a big part of our lives. We need to spend the time on them. As I said, today we're thinking about marriage. And the reason we're starting with marriage is because it's a foundational relationship. It's foundational in family life. It's foundational in society. As I said, we're going to do this in two parts, so there'll be lots of questions we don't come on to this morning that we'll cover in the second part in a few weeks' time. Today I want to ask one question. I'm only going to answer one question, which is, what is a marriage? A very simple question, but it will take us time to work through. What is a marriage? I still remember my friend at work saying to me, I don't need to get married because marriage is just a bit of paper, isn't it? what's going to change if I get married? And his point was, look, I'm already living with my girlfriend. We've already committed to each other. I'm sure they'd slept together. You know, that he sort of said, well, look, nothing will change. It is just a bit of paper. I think the answer to that question has to be at least partly that they've taken all the things already that should have been reserved for marriage. I guess it's a bit like you're hungry and it's dinner time and you see that big apple pie that grandma's baked and it's sitting there steaming on the counter. You go and you eat the whole of the pie for dinner and then saying, what's the point of pudding? I don't need any pudding. Well, you've taken for your dinner what should have been reserved for pudding. I think another thing some people will say, I'm sure you'll hear this, the common view, is marriage is just an old relic from a bygone era. It's something used by men to oppress women. It's something that locks people in and smothers them. Well, yeah, marriage has been abused plenty of times. It's sometimes abused by whole, you know, cultures and societies that come up with rules about marriage that are oppressive. Sometimes it's abused by individuals within the marriage. But that doesn't mean we throw out the baby with the bathwater. You know, same way as if your child came to you and said, I don't like my English teacher, I just can't get on with her, she's really mean and nasty. You wouldn't say, well, English is a rubbish subject anyway, let's get rid of English, we won't bother with it. No, you'd work through it, wouldn't you? You don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Now, when we start in the right place, actually, what we discover that God says is that marriage is good. And one of the reasons it's good is it's a divine gift. So we read in Genesis 2, verse 18. We'll be looking at some of the verses in Genesis 2. You might want to have that in front of you. Genesis 2, verse 18. Who is it that initiates the first marriage? Well, it's God. It's God who says, it's not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him. It's God who comes up with this idea and saying, I'm going to give Adam a wife. So yes, marriage has been mistreated and corrupted, but marriage itself is a gift from God. It comes from him. What actually is a marriage? I want to give you four features of what a marriage is. Hopefully this will answer the question, what is a marriage? Four features. Firstly, marriage has a divine shape. When I say marriage has a divine shape, what I mean by that is God who has shaped. God came up with it, so he has shaped what a marriage actually is. He's given us a pattern in the Bible for what a marriage is. So what shape is it? I'll give you a good definition I've come across in one book, and we'll work through this definition. This writer says, marriage is an exclusive covenant oneness between a man and a woman in the presence of God. Let's work through that sentence, shall we? He says it's exclusive. That's how God designs it. Two people, exclusive as a relationship. He says it's an exclusive covenant. And the Bible uses that language of being a covenant. So if you look, for example, at Malachi chapter 2, verse 14, the Lord there is accusing the people of Israel, men of Israel, of abandoning their wives. And he says they've acted treacherously. And here's what he says, yet she is your companion and your wife by covenant. If you've come across this view, you can read more and more articles about this coming out. People are suggesting more and more that marriage should be a temporary thing, that there's an argument being pushed, more over in the States, I think, but it has come over here as well, that marriage should be something like, let's say, a seven-year contract. That's the amount that's being suggested. Make it a seven-year contract that automatically comes to an end at that point. I guess a bit like you buy your car insurance, well, it's a year long, and then you renew or you go elsewhere. But, you know, the default is it ends after a year. Well, they're saying, do the same with marriage. Make it a seven-year contract. You see the big difference between a contract and a covenant. A covenant is where binding, lifelong, solemn promises are being made. So, marriage is an exclusive covenant oneness. It's the next word, a oneness, a union. So still in Genesis 2, verse 23, Adam can say about Eve, This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. When Jesus is talking about marriage in Matthew chapter 19, verse 4 onwards, he says, they're no longer two but one flesh. And we read the same sort of things in Ephesians 5, where the Apostle Paul's picking up on that same thing, and he uses similar sort of language. Husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. It goes on, Ephesians 5, verse 29, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it. What he's saying, it's a oneness. So that means, in the same way as you wouldn't look at your own hands and think, well, I'm not going to bother washing my hands, I'm not going to bother cutting my toenails or whatever, I'll just let them grow and grow. Well, no, it's a part of your own body, of course you would. He's saying it's the same thing here in a husband-wife relationship. To love your husband or wife is to love yourself. And to mistreat your husband or wife is to mistreat yourself. Now this one flesh, this union, has all sorts of implications. Remember, we said already, we can't possibly spell them all out, but let me give you one or two things, just to get you thinking about this. I haven't seen any statistics for this, but I think most couples in our country today have separate bank accounts. And what they might do, quite a common arrangement is something like they pay into maybe a third account. They'll split the bills equally by paying a set amount of money into a separate account every month. But after that, after we've both paid our amount for our shared bills because we live together, what I've got left over is for me. What she's got left over is for her. It's her money, it's my money, and they're still keeping your money separate. Now, there may be good practical reasons to have more than one bank account, but when you're saying this is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh, that means what's his is hers, and what's hers is his. Can you start to see some of the implications when we see this as a one flesh union? It means you never make a decision in isolation. It means you remind yourself of those vows you've made. Marriage is between a man and a woman. That's the next bit in that statement I gave you. Marriage is an exclusive covenant oneness between a man and a woman. That's why we can't agree with the change to the legal position in our country that allows two men or two women to marry. And God created marriage. This is how he created it. And we will see later on that there is a reason for it. God never just creates things randomly. There is a reason he makes it just for a man and a woman. So marriage has a divine shape. We've gone through some of the features of what that shape is because God created it. Secondly, marriage is a divine separation. What I mean by separation, well, let's look at the verse and I'll explain what I mean by a divine separation. If you look at Genesis 2 verse 24, it says, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. Something really important is happening there. God is telling us how new families are formed, and it's formed by a man and a woman leaving the family units they're currently in, being separated, and I will explain what I mean by separated, it's not as bad as it sounds in some ways, being separated from that and forming a new family unit. So that's why one of the good traditions we have in our marriage ceremonies is the father of the bride being asked, who gives this woman? And he responds, I do. And then he usually sits down, doesn't he? He sort of takes a step back as if to say, I'm now handing her over. So if you see sometimes he'll take her hand and give it to the new husband as a way of saying, you're leaving my family unit and you're going to form your own new family unit now. That's what the verse in Genesis says. Leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. That union creates a new family unit. Again, there can be some very practical implications to that. And this is quite a it comes up very commonly. Sometimes what can happen is that the parents still want to see their role as being the same as it was before the marriage. They can still almost act as if nothing's changed and the family unit is still the same. so they can end up, we'll say, telling their son, well, this is where I think you should be living. Or, this is how you must bring up your children. You need to do it that way. As if nothing's changed. Or you can find situations where a wife, a new wife, is going back to her parents, listening to the parents, and cutting the new husband out of the loop, and only ever taking advice from her parents, and doing whatever they do, and trusting their advice, and not the advice of her new husband. And the husband can end up feeling cut out. I'm not describing here my own situation. Please don't read things into it that you're not meant to read, okay? I'm describing common scenarios throughout all of this. I suppose what I'm saying is the danger with leaving and cleaving is either that the children don't really leave and cleave, or that the parents psychologically haven't let them leave and cleave. Again, all sorts of implications for how we work this out in our families. It means if you've got a son or a daughter who's grown up, become an adult, got married, and this is where I'm saying separation doesn't mean, of course it doesn't mean you cut them off. That's not what I mean by that word. Yeah, you give advice, support, care, prayer, lots of ways in which you can care and so on. But you must recognise they've formed a new family unit now. And if you're married yourself, it means recognising that as well, that there's a clean break there. Not cutting people off, but we've started a new family unit here. There are all sorts of ways you put that into practice. I remember one of the things we thought through after we got married. I am talking about myself now. And you can tell because I'm telling you I'm doing it, okay? One of the things we thought about soon after we got married is, well, we're not necessarily going to go on the big family holiday straight away. I think it was something like a two-week family holiday, and we didn't go for some of it. We did something by ourselves. And I'm not saying it would have been wrong to go, but to us, to me, it was just one of the ways in which we could say to ourselves, really, we're a new family unit now. We will decide for ourselves what we do about holidays. We won't necessarily join in the family holiday every year. Now, we do all this while still obeying the fifth commandment. The command to honour your father and mother. That doesn't change. That isn't crossed out of our Bibles when we get married. But the way we obey it does change. Thirdly, the third thing about marriage. Marriage is a divine creation. I said that marriage is a divine gift. And the fact that God created marriage means that he sets the conditions for it. Let me ask you a question to try and get you thinking. What are the key things, what are the bare essentials that you need to have in order to have a genuine marriage? Let's say you've got two people who want to get married. What are the things where you'd say, well, without that, it won't be a real marriage. If you take that away, it won't count. I ask that because there are lots of things about marriages that are cultural. They may be good, they may be bad. But they're cultural, but they're not essential. As I'm sure you know, it doesn't have to be in a church. It doesn't have to be conducted by a minister to be a lawful marriage in our country. You don't have to kiss the bride at the end of your vows. You don't have to have a photo of two people holding a knife pretending to cut a cake. You might choose to do that if you want to, but you don't have to. It doesn't make the marriage invalid. There are all sorts of cultural things. And then there are all sorts of things in UK law that you need to make a marriage to be declared legal in our country. So some things that we just do almost without thinking about it because they're cultural, there are some things that you need to do if you want a legally valid marriage. So you have to be over the age of 16. It has to be at a place that's registered for marriage. So, for example, if you decided you wanted to go out and get married on the top of Pilly Mountain with the wind sweeping through your hair, you can't. You couldn't just go and do that because it's not on the government's approved premises list. And I know because I checked, not because I'm thinking of getting married there, I just thought it would be an interesting thing to look at. So there's all these government rules, but every country will have slightly different rules. And so you've got, if you think of it this way, you've got government rules down here, but God's rules have to sit above that, and they may differ to the government's rules. So it's not as easy as saying, well, whatever the government says is a marriage, that's what a marriage actually is. I'm going to go back to Genesis 2, verse 21. I think there are three essentials there. Here are the three things God says make a marriage, because you notice they do differ to our own legal requirements for a marriage. Three things in Genesis 2, verse 21. Firstly, we've said this already, it has to be a conscious leaving the old family unit. A man has to leave his father and mother. We've said what leave does and doesn't mean already. That means the parents consenting to that, agreeing to send their daughter or their son off into this new family arrangement. That's the first thing. It has to be believing. Secondly, because it's a covenant, there have to be vows. I know the word vow doesn't appear in here, but we talked about one flesh and how, and we looked at that verse in Malachi where it says it is a covenant relationship. To have a covenant relationship, you have to make promises. Promises of what you will and won't do. And that's what the vows are in a marriage ceremony. So there have to be vows and promises. And thirdly, and this is in the verse again, they have to become one flesh. Now, yes, we've described how that means in terms of the change of relationship, but that also has to include physical intimacy as well. We don't use the word consummated much anymore, but there's something to be said about that word. It's a good word. The marriage has to be consummated. Now, again, this is one of those examples where we'd say, there are all sorts of scenarios, physical struggles that mean that may not always be possible. And we can't go into every situation, but we're laying out God's principles for how he would want them to be in a perfect world. It's just that we can't always follow them as we would want to. But that the purpose of sex, the reason God gives sex, is that it's an act that demonstrates that one flesh union between a man and a woman. And that's it. I would say they are the bare bones of a marriage in that verse. He doesn't give us a form of words. He doesn't give us a restriction on age. He doesn't give us particular locations. If those things are present, I always end up thinking about things as I'm saying. I'm not suggesting marriage for children, by the way, here. I'm just saying there is no age limit given in the Bible. Countries may choose to make these rules. Again, this has implications, though. Let's play out a scenario just to think about this a bit more. Imagine, and we pray this isn't the case, but do you know, you couldn't rule this out. Imagine if our government made a rule, introduced a law, saying that in order for you to get married, you had to sign a form saying, I agree with our government's definition of marriage. And that includes same-sex marriage. That includes two men or two women getting married. I don't know about you, I couldn't do that. I couldn't sign a statement saying, I agree that two women can get married. The law of the land may permit it, but it doesn't meet God's requirements for a marriage. Now, would that mean I could never get married? Because I can't meet the government's requirements? Does that mean I have to stay single? I can't get married all my life? Well, I'd say no. You can get married in God's eyes. Because those requirements for God to see it as a real marriage can be met without you signing a government's form. It means that legally, in the eyes of the law in our country, you'll be seen as a single person. But God says, no, you can still get married. Another implication. A long time ago, someone said to me, oh, I've messed up big time. I went out, I got drunk, and I slept with a girl. I feel rubbish about it. I wish I hadn't done it. Some people would say, well, you're married now then. You're one flesh. So now you need to go through the vows and so on to make it official, but actually you've become husband and wife in what you did. Say no, because it takes us back to these principles here. What does God say makes a marriage? Well, did you promise to her to stay faithful in a relationship? No. Did you make any promises? No. Well, that means you're not married, and you don't have to marry her. Yes, it was wrong and sinful, and you need to repent, and there are all sorts of consequences, but it doesn't mean you're married. You can see there's lots of examples we don't have time to play out, but when we've got the principles in place, we can start to work through some of the questions around them. Fourthly, and finally, marriage is a divine picture. We said last week, we are relational because God, in his own being, Father, Son, and Spirit, is relational. And the types God chooses for a relationship God chooses for us are deliberate. Why did he choose to give the human race marriage? Why didn't he choose some other type of relationship for our race, for humanity? And I think the big answer to that, or at least one of the big answers, has to be, it's because of the bigger picture of the relationship between Jesus Christ and his church. So if you've got your Bibles, this would probably be the right time to go back over to Ephesians. We read Ephesians 5. If you look at Ephesians 5, verses 31 to 32, you'll recognise verse 31. Ephesians 5, verse 31. It's reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. He's quoting Genesis. We just looked at very similar wording. And then he goes on in verse 32 and says, this is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Jesus is saying that marriage is a picture of Jesus' love for his church, for his people. That's why in the Old Testament, God often uses the picture of marriage to explain Israel's sin. Books like Hosea, he says, look, what you've done to me is like you going off with another woman. The vows two people make to one another, to love one another, to be faithful to one another, are a visual demonstration of the lifelong vows that Jesus has made to his people. In marriage, where the two become one flesh. And that's a great picture of the union of Jesus Christ to his people. That I can say, I am permanently joined together with Jesus. That means what's mine is his. Just like a husband would say to the wife, everything I have, I give to you. Everything that's mine is Jesus's because I'm married to him. I can't say, no, Jesus, not that part of my life. No, Jesus, don't take this bit. Everything I have is mine because I'm joined to him. It's all his. And it means as well that what's his is mine. Now, that's the most incredible thing to think about. In the same way that the husband and the wife are sharing everything, being joined to Jesus Christ means everything he has now belongs to me too. He does not withhold anything. Jesus loves every one of his children, and the picture he's giving us is that he has married himself to them. He says, you're my bride. We share everything. Think about some of the things that means. You can think about it in terms of the commonly used vows that people make in a wedding ceremony. When Jesus says he promises to love us, he promises to comfort us, to honour us, to protect us. Imagine, think about that. The Son of God himself promises to protect you. He's promised to keep us in sickness and in health. He's promised to keep us for richer and for poorer. He's promised not to forsake us if we lose our jobs or if we get ill, if we need round-the-clock care and we're confined to our beds. And he's promised to do it forsaking all others. In other words, he's not going to lose interest in us. He's not going to betray us. He's committed, totally committed to his people in the church. Promised to be faithful, and the phrase in the wedding ceremony is, for as long as you both shall live. Jesus promises eternal, permanent love for you as one of his children. Every time you see a man and a woman making those promises and trying to live them out, It's a great picture of the kind of love that Jesus has for his people. And you know, if you're not a Christian, a simple question to ask you is, why wouldn't you want? Jesus offers to give you everything he has. He offers you eternal love from God himself. He offers to protect you and care for you. He offers to take you under the shelter of his wings. That's what he holds out to you as an offer. You won't get a better offer than that. See, when we think about this divine picture, that marriage is a picture of Jesus' love for the church, that's what helps us understand why so many of the attempts to redefine marriage fall short and why we just couldn't go along with them. Back in 2012, you probably remember this, you might remember this in the news, there was this lady, an elderly lady, who tried to restore a fresco on the wall of a Spanish cathedral. This beautiful old picture, been painted there, been there for centuries, and in trying to repaint it, where the paint had sort of come off a bit and so on, she just completely butchered it. She gave him a really odd-shaped mouth. His hair and his beard just turned into this weird sort of circle of hair going around him. It looked awful. Well, that's what's happening when people try and redefine marriage. It's like taking a big marker pen to the Mona Lisa. You can't improve it. You're going to just destroy the picture. Marriage is a picture. And we lose the picture when we change what marriage is. So that's why we can't accept marriage just being a 7-year contract. I mean, apart from all the practical and so on difficulties of that, we're not just being picky. It's like saying Jesus' commitment to rescue me and love me is limited to a 7-year time frame, and after that he might love somebody else. Where's the security for me in that? If he only promises to love me for 7 years. The whole picture of Jesus' eternal love goes when we change that. It's why we can't accept a marriage where there's more than two partners, because the whole picture of Jesus and his church, two partners, sharing, united together. It's the same reason we can't accept a marriage as being valid between two men or two women, because Jesus and the church are not the same. They're not identical. They're two different beings coming together in a beautiful union. It's why we can't say that sex outside of marriage is okay, because sex is a picture of marital faithfulness. Husband faithful to wife, wife faithful to husband. Just like Jesus is faithful to me, to his church. Do you know, it's an amazing thing to be married when you think about what the picture is. If you're married, just stop and think about your marriage for a moment. I know there are flaws in it. Okay, I know that. I may not know your marriage, but I know there are flaws in it. I know there will be small things. I know there'll be the fact that he leaves his dirty socks on the floor. Even though he knows where the washing basket is. And I know she keeps on putting banana skins on the food waste, even though it obviously needs changing. Again, these are random examples, by the way. I know there'll be times when you find yourself, and maybe there'll be times you think, who is this stranger I married? She's changed so much. He's so different to who that person was. I thought I really knew them. I know there'll be small issues. And I know there may be big issues too. However big or small, whatever those issues are, whatever those flaws and those sins, that they're there and they're real. And the reason they're real is because it's a marriage between two sinners. But even in spite of that, don't also miss the glory that's inherent in every single marriage. Because every marriage, however pale this reflection may be, is a reflection of Jesus' overflowing, committed, faithful, passionate, eternal covenant love towards sinners. Every marriage is that. If you're not married, I said it is relevant. This is relevant for all of us because it's a picture for us. So take a moment to think about the marriages of other people in your life. God's given those marriages to you to be that picture. In the same way that God's given us a rainbow, and every time you step outside and you see the rainbow in the sky, it's a picture for us, isn't it? It's a reminder. We're meant to think about something when we see the rainbow. Well, the same thing here. You're meant to think about stuff when you see a marriage. Yet, however imperfect it may be, the sins will be there and they'll be real. But we've got to look beyond that as well. Look past the fact that when your friend talks to you about her husband, she always, she says, oh, he's always going down to the pub and I really need help with stuff at home, but he's just never here. Look past the grumpiness of how your friend says his wife often isn't. And look for what the picture represents, even when it's pale. I remember, it's one of those things I wouldn't have thought about as a child, but I think back to it now. I think back of my parents' marriage. And I remember how sometimes my dad would get up really early for work, and he'd have left the house before anyone was up. And sometimes he'd leave little notes on the kitchen table for my mum. And being a boy, I used to read them. And I shouldn't have done. I know, I'm not condoning this. You shouldn't read letters that aren't addressed to you. But it was on the kitchen table, you're eating breakfast, you end up looking at this note. Very little, brief, a few sentences, but they were just affectionate, caring notes. I'll be thinking of you today, love you lots, those sorts, normal sorts of things, I suppose. When I look back at something like that now, what I can see when I'm looking for it is I can see a little glimpse of Jesus' love for me. The notes were unnecessary, didn't need to be written. My mum knew, my dad loved it, but Jesus so often sends us little tokens of, strictly unnecessary, but tokens that are reminders of his affection and his care for us. So look for them in the marriages around you. You'll see bad stuff as well, I know that. But even in the bad stuff, you can see it as, look how different Jesus is. Jesus isn't like this, and he doesn't do that. But especially in the good things, when you see a husband caring for his bedridden wife through illness, the wife supporting her husband when he's lost his job and he feels just so useless, and what's he going to do with his time? Wherever we see those things in a marriage, God says, you're meant to also see my great covenant, eternal love for you, for my people. That's what marriage is for. As I said, there's lots of questions we haven't thought about today. I'm sure you'll be able to think of lots of other things about marriage. We'll cover, hopefully, a lot of the main ones in a couple of weeks' time when we think about this subject again.